So it's a great pleasure and privilege to have a chance to talk to Barry Cavern, who I've known for some years in King's. Barry, when and where were you born?
I was born in 1942 in a very small village in Yorkshire called Wandsworth, which is, nearest town is Doncaster. It was a tiny village, and it was right in the middle of a coal mining area. Edlington Main, Cadeby Colliery, Maltby Colliery, all around that little village there were collieries. In fact, the only industry for that area was coal mining.
Mm. So were your parents coal miners?
No, my mother wasn't, but my father was. I was the first male in my family not to go down the coal mines.
Really? Gosh. Yeah. For how many generations?
Oh, for four generations. And thank goodness I didn't. Mm. My father, actually, he got trapped in the mine with a fall and did himself an injury and then stopped mining and used the money to buy himself a small business. And the business sort of went well, and he moved into a bigger business, and so it went on. So
what kind of business?
Into a hotel business. Mm. What a small hotel. Mm. Well, he first of all started off with a golf club where he got his training, and then he went into getting a hotel. But the story I'm recollecting now is what was recalled to me rather than basically remembering it, because although I was born in 42, my father was at war, and my grandfather had died, and my great-grandfather had died. And so I was brought up in a house full of women. Mm. And I was absolutely spoiled rotten some of the time. I had three women all competing for my attention.
Mother, grandmother, and who was the other?
Great-grandmother.
Oh. Mm. Do you remember anything about your great-grandmother?
Oh, yes, I do. Yeah.
Tell me about
very,
her.
Very close to her. She was a really grand old matriline who everybody, even the sons, my uncles, and were sort of listened to and didn't dare contradict or say anything that would upset her. But she was, because I couldn't do anything wrong, she was extremely generous and helpful to me. I guess, according to my mother, she brought me through life in that I was born prematurely. I had only weighed just over 4 pounds, which during the war, there were no incubators or anything. Mm. The nurses told my grandmother, not my mother, that I wouldn't stand a chance of surviving. My grandmother brought me through by feeding me little drips of sugar and water because I couldn't suckle very well. So that's truly amazing. Mm. I can still remember my great grandmother's co-op number. I can't remember her telephone number, but I remember that number because I used to go and do her groceries for her. Even after we'd left there and my parents got a house and we lived away, I used to go back there at weekends, and I always used to go and do a shopping for her and go to the court and buy things there. Hmm. So I went to a junior school which had two classes for the whole junior school, so you're mixed with different years. And it was an old stone junior school with no lavatories, just a hole in the sort of in the field, actually, right at the bottom of the playground. Mm. And I also remember having to queue up every morning to get a spoonful of cod liver oil and a spoonful to follow with of orange juice.
Strange tasting orange juice.
Yeah, yeah, it was, but they were, I mean, I don't, I kind of, I didn't have any sort of traumas in my childhood at all. Everything just seemed to go sailing along. I was forever happy. I can't think of any real unhappiness I had. It was a bit tough for me when my father came back from the war, because you know, I'd been spoiled rotten, and he started being more of a sort of disciplinarian, so that took some getting used to. But apart from that, everything went fine.
What sort of character were your parents and as people?
They were working class, very pleased to have made it into being independent, but that was by the time I went to university. Mm. I mean, up until that time, I was not independent. And and so they did well out of
loving and encouraging and.
Well, yes, they were loving, but it was not open. There was this Yorkshire way, and male chauvinist way of not showing emotions. And my mother almost felt a little bit kind of ashamed when she was openly emotional. Didn't like people to see that. Whereas my great-grandmother was always open and loving and kind and cuddling and things. So there was, I wouldn't say that I had a lot of love and physical attention, although I knew that they were always there and always cared about me, and I could ask for whatever I wanted, and you know, they would be helpful in that way. But I was kind of left to grow up in my own way, as it were.
You had brothers and
sisters?
Both
parents were working. I had a younger brother, Both parents were working, and he went into the family business. And I'd come home from school in the evening and let myself in and get myself something to eat. And I became fairly able to look after myself, really. That was even at junior school from a young age. I mean, in those days you could do that. Now your parents would be locked up for doing that. But in those days it was quite common.
Were you, on the edge of beautiful country, even if it's mainly coal mines? Did you roam around?
I did, yeah. There was a lot of countryside. The river was the River Don, which was terribly polluted. I always used to think it looked nice because it had all this foam on top of it by the waterfall. And it was only later in life that I realised it was through pollution. I used to walk a lot around.
Did you have hobbies like collecting anything or studying anything?
In those early days, I'm talking now when I was at junior school. I was just a stamp collector. That was the only thing I did. I still got that stamp collection somewhere, but that was the only thing really I did. Oh, I was interested in sport as well. I was interested in sprinting, running.
Were there any teachers at that junior school who affected you in any way?
Not particularly, no. I mean, the classes were huge. The classes were between 50 and 60 kids in a class, and it was massive. And I did my 11 plus there, and I think there were, out of all of the two classes that took the examination, there were only 9, I think it was, who went to grammar school.
And you were one of them?
I was one of them. I passed my 11 plus and went to grammar school. And then at grammar school.
Which grammar school was it?
Well, I actually passed for Doncaster Grammar School because the junior school I went to was in the borough. But then I was told that because we lived out of the borough, because this village, Warmsworth, is just on the periphery out of the borough, they said I couldn't go to the grammar school. So I went to Mexborough Grammar School, which was West Riding of Yorkshire. So it was all part of West Riding. But I wasn't allowed to go to the town Doncaster Grammar School. And that was a massive grammar school, co-ed, over 1,000 students, 5 streams in each year. And in those days we were streamed. You went into, you know, not only did you do your 11 plus, but you were then subsequently streamed to get into whatever stream was appropriate. And I got into the top stream. But I never ever came first in the class. It was always girls who came first, second. The highest I ever came was third. But I sailed through school without any problems. I got the cane twice, once for whistling in the corridor, and once for eating in the street. So although it was a state, traditional grammar school, they maintained very strict discipline. I never thought anything of it, getting the cane. I mean, it was quite a good thing to have done in a way, because otherwise, you know, you got brownie points with all of the other lads in the school. You got accepted as being normal, as it were. I didn't go out of the way to get it. But on the other hand, a discipline was tight, without question or doubt. I mean, not usually caning; it was usually what they called detention. And I very seldom got detention because I was quite conscientious about my work.
Were there any teachers there who
Yes, there were. There were teachers there that I liked very much. I can't remember the names now, but the biology teacher in particular I thought was wonderful. Mm. He really made things interesting and stimulating.
Mm.
And I guess chemistry was pretty dull, I have to say. And we all had to do it, and physics.
Did the biology teacher sort of take you out on expeditions?
Yes, we did. Yes, we went on to field courses and things like that.
Mm.
And that was quite eye opening.
Mm.
And I enjoyed that very much. I also at secondary school played chess.
Okay.
That became one of my hobbies. Mm. And I played for the school, and I then played for the county. And then when I went to university, I played for the university.
Mm.
But I played with 70 boards. We played one of the Russian grandmasters, and I lost. But nobody beat him. And I suddenly realised that, gosh, I thought I was good at chess, but I'm not. I'm a million miles from being good at chess. You know how you kind of sail through, and everything you do, the standards that you come up against, you're high, and the standards you come up against are high. Then suddenly you meet somebody who is really first class, and you suddenly realise, oh, no, this is... And so I stopped playing. I gave up. Well, not entirely gave up, but I stopped playing, as it were, seriously, because I realised there's nothing I could do to become that good.
Mm.
Not that, I mean, when I say nothing I could do, I wasn't prepared to sacrifice absolutely everything, every minute of every day, to play chess.
Mm.
I played chess because I enjoyed playing it, and I enjoyed winning it as well. But there was no chance that I could put the amount of time and effort into become that good.
Mm. What about other games? You mentioned sprinting. Were you still running, or...?
I did, not particularly. What I took up, this is now when I went to university, what I took up was mountaineering, climbing.
Mm.
And I used to go quite often down to Harrison's Rocks in Tunbridge Wells, which is just south of London, and to Lamberis Pass up in Wales, up to the Lake District, up to the Cornwall, Zenner Cove, the rocks down there. So pretty well all over the country, and in Scotland, climbing. We used to go up to Scotland every winter and go mountaineering, that was, rather than rock climbing. So it's pretty walking and mountaineering up in the Larry Grew, up in the Highlands of Scotland. That was absolutely terrific. One year we rescued the SAS. they had been put out on a mission, these four guys, dressed in civilian clothes, and it can be bitterly cold.
Mm. Our king was Lord. Mm.
I remember the eggs froze solid, and these two guys came to our tent and said, because we were out in the middle of nowhere, and you know, there's no civilization. In fact, it's the most distant place you can be from any civilization in the British Isles. And these guys came and said, we've got problems, two of our men have collapsed, and they're in serious need of rescue. And so we let them have one of our tents, we had two tents, they had one of our tents and sleeping bags. And they wrote to us afterwards and sent us a new tent. Well, no, they reconditioned the tent, that's right, they reconditioned the tents and sent us our things back, and they were very grateful, and the guys survived. But they didn't tell us very much about it, except that they were on a mission, and that we later realised they were special services.
Mm.
So yeah, they were adventurous days, and I enjoyed that. And after university, I took a year out and went to Africa, to the Mountains of the Moon initially, to do mountaineering there, and to do a biological project.
Mm.
That we set up to get, and it was a university expedition, so we got funding from various places to help pay us for this. And I went out on a boat with a super numerary crew, sailed all the way down the Suez Canal,
Mountains of the Moon are in Kenya?
Kenya or Inzuri.
Yeah.
Out on the border. In fact, when we got there, we were told not to go up there because there was a war going on in the Congo, and there were a lot of guerrilla forces coming up into the Rwenzoris, and they said that they would probably shoot us just to get the food and any supplies we had with us, because you know, and they showed us some horrific pictures of people who had been massacred in the Rwenzoris by these. I'm trying to remember what they were called now. They were Congolese. I've forgotten the names. But anyway, they've sort of fled the war zones and were camping in the foothills of the Rwenzoris on the Congo side. And I beg your pardon. The Congo is the Rwenzoris in Uganda, not Kenya. Mm. Uganda and the Congo up on that roof there. I mean, beautiful mountains. So we transferred our project to Mount Kenya because it has the same kind of Afro, what they call Afro-Alpine zone, like you get in the Rwenzoris, where you get the different, you know, you get the rainforest and then you get the bamboo zone and then you get the Yabawaki forest and then the grass tussocks and then you're up on the snow line. And so we transferred to Mount Kenya and spent, I think it was 8 or 9 months up Mount Kenya. Ran out of food in the end, apart from peas. So we were just living on peas virtually for 2 weeks before the porters arrived the next time, because the porters came up periodically to bring our food supplies, but they were not very punctual. They came when they suited them to come, sort of thing. So we had a great time there. There were four of us there, and we've remained very close friends ever since. We bonded and very much were in each other's hands in terms of survival. So we were living at, 14,500 feet for 6 months. And we did some climbing, because that's really what we were into, as well as doing the biology. And the biology was asking questions about the fauna, but also about the flora, because you get extremely high fluctuations in day-night temperature. I mean, going to as low as minus 20 and going up into the 70s in the sun, because it's right on the equator now. And we were interested in how any flora could possibly survive, and why the plants there grew to such gigantic size, because you had the senecios and lobelias, which grew up taller than a man, huge great size. And what we found was that although we put thermistors in the plants at different heights, this is the first time I've talked about this for 40 years, I'm just remembering it, recalling it now, we put thermistors in the plants and found in fact that what happens at night is the leaves close up, and so the temperature, the core temperature, doesn't go below zero. But what happens is it's a continual dying process, so that the plants get bigger because the leaves die and, as it were, coat the stems and allow it to survive. Then during the daytime it's all metabolic process and growth. At night growth slows down and death occurs of parts of the plant, which protects the rest of the plant. So it got me interested in biology, in the sense of doing things and thinking about things for the first time.
This path we've taken has been along mountains and mountain climbing, and really the point of departure was your school. So if we can go back just to finish off in the school, a couple of things. One is, were there any other sort of extramural activities, student politics, drama, music, that was it. You were beginning to get interested.
Well, I wasn't hugely interested, but you know, I was in the school play, and I was Oh, I played a violin. Yes, I did. I played a violin. I gave up. I've forgotten I gave up playing that. In fact, I played the violin at junior school, and I gave a solo concert there. Well, not a concert, but they call it a solo to the town in the town hall. At the age of 10, I think it was. And my music master thought I was destined to become a famous musician. But when I went to grammar school, I have to confess, I didn't tell them that I played a musical instrument. Because, again, it was something that, to be good, you had to put a lot of time into it. And so I was very much into trying to be male, as it were, and do male-like things rather than do things that I particularly wanted to excel at.
But did you maintain an interest in music? I mean, do you listen to music?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Do you listen to it a lot?
Yes, I do.
What kind of music do you like?
Well, my favourite music is, as I get older, I think it's very much Bach.
Bach?
Yeah. Mm. But I also, I like the old Gregorian chant, I like the Mahler, and a whole range of musicians, both old and relatively new.
Mm.
Composers, not musicians, composers. But I haven't. It's something I do to relax to, rather than do out of an intellectual pursuit, which I did much more so. It was much more intellectual in terms of getting to know all of the different composers and different types of music when I was at university. Then I spent a lot of time listening to music and getting to know music.
Does the relaxation help your work? I mean, do you listen to music to let your mind calm down from work, or as an inspiration to work? Is it related in any way to...
No, not as an inspiration. I just do it to relax, just to sit quiet time. Yeah.
The other thing that often happens at around that age, i.e. 15, 16, is either a movement towards or away from formal religion. It's a time that some people are confirmed. I don't know what your parents...
No, I was never confirmed. My parents weren't overtly religious. They, if you ask them if they believed in God, yes, they did. And they went to sort of births, marriages and funerals, really. So I wasn't brought up in any religious way. I found out, after my mother had died, in fact, that her father, my grandfather on my mother's side, this is the other grandmothers I was talking about, I never knew her because she died very early, when I was about 1 or 2 years old. But on that side of the family, my father, my mother's father, my grandfather on that side, who did live to a ripe old age into his 90s and was a First World War hero, he fell out with his father, who was a rabbi. And he married somebody who was not Jewish. His wife was not Jewish. And more to the point, he signed up to go to war. This is in the First World War, without his father agreeing to it. And so he was literally cast out of the family from his brothers and father, and they just wouldn't talk to him. And so I guess my mother wasn't brought up in any religious way for that reason. Nor was I, nor my brother.
And what has your religious development been? I mean, talking to a number of people, it seems that the physicists are a fairly mystical bunch, whereas the biologists tend to be of the Dawkins persuasion.
Well, I'm certainly not of the Dawkins persuasion, because I think he's just as evangelical as the evangelists. I believe in beliefs. I believe that beliefs are enormously important. We all need them. They're crucially important. And I would be the last person to want to deny anyone something that they believed in that gave them a sense of comfort or well-being, that a sense of peace with themselves, if you like. But I myself believe that my beliefs are very much in humanity and the future of mankind, and trying to ensure that we keep our environment as habitable and ecologically normal as possible. I mean, so I do believe that things, there are important things. For me, the important things are the here and now ones, rather than what might happen at some future time, if there is such a future time.
Yeah. So Dawkins' argument that Darwin has disproved religion, do you think it's...
Well, I don't think that Darwin has disproved religion, because Darwin himself, he was a religious man, and then I think it was more the death of his daughter, wasn't it, that kind of made him disaffected. And his wife still remained very religious, and they were together. So I think that if he had been anti-religion, really anti-religion, he would never have got on with his wife and family. Mm. And so I think that he too was tolerant of religions, even though he himself, latterly, I guess he didn't believe, although I have no evidence for that. But, I certainly don't believe in special creation. I can't accept that. And I do believe in evolution firmly and profoundly. And I believe it's infinitely more complex than we might imagine it as being. But nevertheless, I'm absolutely committed to it and very interested in it. And in fact, in this last few years, most of my thinking time has been thinking about evolution and how things have come about. And how, in particular, one of the things that particularly interests me at that level is the, since humans are continuing, evolution continuing with animals, what makes us so much different? And is that what makes us, what are the evolutionary steps that have made us that little bit different? Don't get me wrong, depending on what kind of level you want to look, you know, cellular, molecular, genetic, you know, we are remarkably, incredibly similar to all other living creatures. But at the level of brain evolution, we are really something quite special. Mm-hmm. And of course, my interest in brain and behavior, and therefore a great deal of interest is I have, so far as how the brain, our brain came to be what it is and how it makes us different from other animals, whilst at the same time being remarkably similar.
Mm. Well, that's a very fascinating area, which perhaps we'll come back to.
Sure.
And we'll discuss.
I'd be delighted to come back to
But just coming back to your progress through education. You'd obviously got into a science stream, and they were subjects which interested you.
Sixth form of science stream,
And
although, believe it or not, in the lower school, I was in what they call the art stream. I'd been streamed. So then when I went into the science stream, I had to take my O-level and A-level chemistry in the 2 years, because I hadn't done chemistry. So...
And you found it fairly dull, with these.
I did, But I did it.
You did it. And then was it obvious that you would try for university at the end of...
Yes, it was. Oh, yeah. I mean, the school was bent on that happening. Although, again, I was the first person in my family to go to university. First. I have cousins who have also gone. They were younger than me. Only one. There was another, a cousin who was a year younger than me. And other cousins ever since.
And where did you go?
I went to London University.
Which part?
It was called Queen Elizabeth College, but it was part of King's College, and is part of King's College now. I'm King's alumni, King's London letters.
And how was that? Did you enjoy it?
I did. I loved it. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. It was a real eye-opener, being in London and being independent and away from home. And I have to say, I didn't put as much time and effort into my academic work as I did into my social life and being on societies and chairing societies and various things in the university and the college. And I had a terrific time. I really enjoyed it.
This was 1961, isn't it?
This would be 61 to 64, yeah.
Yep.
And then I took a year out to go to Africa. When I came back, I decided, having taken that year out, that really the thing I was interested in was doing research. I couldn't face up to doing it any kind of routine job. I knew I'd never survive. I felt I just had to do something which I would find interesting.
What did you read at university? What was the subject?
Physiology.
Physiology.
Yeah.
Were there any notable teachers? Huxley wasn't there. He taught a bit in London at one point.
I certainly wasn't taught by him. Mm. Actually, the person that I admired in those days was J.Z. Young. I used to go and listen to J.Z. Young's lectures. I thought he was a wonderful, wonderful biologist.
Mm.
He had an enormous knowledge and grasp of biology. And he was also he had a very evolutionary approach, which I think was what kind of stimulated me to think more about evolution. Because I was interested in brain and behaviour, I did my PhD at the Institute of Psychiatry.
Did you? Tavistock, is that one or not?
No, it's not. It's absolutely the opposite of Tavistock. Tavistock is very much Freudian analytical, whereas the Maudsley Institute of Psychiatry is very much biological. And I did my PhD there, and did very well out of it, and a postdoc.
What was the subject of the thesis?
I was interested in the way in which hormones influence behaviour. And they had a very powerful effect on behaviour in rodents and small brain mammals, but nobody had really looked to see if they had any impact on behaviour in large brain mammals. And I worked with monkeys. And I was very interested in what motivated females in terms of their sexual activity with respect to their cycle. The problem was that the work done in the field was very incomplete in those days, and any work done in the lab had just said, well, monkeys mate at all times, sort of thing. But what I did is I set up a system whereby, because the male is so much bigger than the female, the male tend to dominate the relationship, and especially if you're looking at them in captivity, even though it's a very large cage, nevertheless, the males are much bigger, and if they want to mate, they will go and mate. So I emancipated the female from the male's influence by having a partition across the cage with a door that moved. If the female pressed the lever quite rigorously, she was on I got it up to a fixed ratio schedule of 500 to 1. So she had to press that lever 500 times to open the door.
Gosh.
And she would do that within 2 or 3 minutes, actually. Very, very fast. She'd rattle away. And that would open the door. And the door was too small for the male to get through. So the female could go through. And then there's a lever on the other side. She wanted to press, she could come out. And the outcome of that was actually the female pressed that lever to get with the male on every day of the cycle. All the females did. But what was interesting is sometimes, and the times when it was, the female was more interested in the male, was at mid-cycle around the time, about the time she ovulated. So then she would press very hard for the male to get to the female. The other thing, she would press very hard for her to get to the male. The other thing that interested me was the male's interest in the female. All of the evidence suggested that the things that interested males about females was the sex skin colour, the bright colours that they have on their backside as a sexual signal. But in fact, I found that had no impact whatsoever. You could artificially make that the bright colour because it's due to a vasodilation. And if you just put an estrogen cream on there, it will go bright red. And with in low concentration, so it doesn't affect the brain at all. And the males were not interested in that. But what the males were interested in, their interest was in the smell of the female, olfaction. The males were interested in the female, in the female's pheromones. So I did the converse of the female experiment. I gave the males an opportunity to press for access to the female. But what I used was females that were overectomized and unreceptive to males, but I just changed their attractiveness by changing their odor. And males would press for the, in inverted commas, attractive females, the ones that smelled right. But that's kind of breaking things down at a mechanistic level of A, looking at the hormones and how they're impacting on the brain for behavior, looking at the hormones and how they're impacting in the periphery on behaviour. And generally speaking, hormones are synchronising both things together throughout most of biology, really. I'll come on to that later if I get to talk about pregnancy. But what I realised after doing this, I then started to look at what happens when you do this in a social group. So if you now make a female attractive with pheromones, putting artificial, because we did the analysis, the chemical analysis, and pulled out the important ingredients, and we could make up these artificial odors and put them on females. But if we did it in a social group, it had no impact whatsoever. So it became clear that you could get it to have an impact, but it would not. I mean, males were interested in the dominant. Or any females at all if they were a dominant male. And so I then went to look at the way in which social hierarchy has an impact on behaviour. And what I found was, again, it became inverted in that an animal's status was much more important for the behaviour than the hormones. You know, you could castrate a male, say, and he would still continue to be interested in females for a long time, and he would still be high ranking for a long time. The converse of that was if a male lost rank through social interactions, social reasons, sexual behaviour stopped immediately and never started up again. Status was correlated, rank was correlated with male hormone levels, with testosterone. But if you if a male lost rank, the testosterone would go down. But a low-ranking male, you could give them testosterone up to their ears, and it had no impact on their behaviour. It didn't affect their rank. They didn't go up the hierarchy. It didn't affect their behaviour with the females. So suddenly, after spending 4 years, 5 years, working on how hormones have an impact on behaviour, I suddenly realised that you've got to get these things into context, that context being the situation, the social situation in which the animal normally lives. So I suddenly realised that social hierarchies were very much more important. But social hierarchies not only affected the male, I also found that they could affect the female too. And they could affect the female in the sense that low-ranking females were less likely to ovulate. They became anovulatory. They didn't show an LH surge, and they didn't show an LH surge even by challenging the brain, which controls the ovulation. patient, even by challenging the brain with the appropriate hormones which normally bring it about, they simply wouldn't have a response in the downstream organs. And so you had a social suppression of reproduction in low-ranking individuals.
Very interesting. Mm. Who was supervising this?
That work was supervised originally in London with the operant work, that is the Leverpressing the Nails, that was with a Richard Michael. What happened was, I was offered a job, and there were two or three people in the States who were interested in the work I was doing, and offered me positions, and I applied for a fellowship, an American fellowship, and I didn't get it. So, okay, I didn't get it. And this Richard Michael allowed me to continue, not allowed me, he wanted me to continue, so I was doing very good work. I mean, I think I had something like 6 or 7 papers in Nature and Science over the course of 3 years, which was pretty good going. I mean, plus other papers as well in lesser journals. I can't remember which they were. Anyway, we're going back to the late 60s, early 70s here. Anyway, about a year after that, not getting there, Richard Michael invited me to go to the States. He says, I'm moving to the States, and I want to take you over with me. I've got a position, you have a senior postdoc position, tenure post, and senior postdoc with tenure track. And do come along, I'll give you every opportunity. Well, I actually wanted at this stage, I mean, I wanted to make a move, because I thought, you know, I've been in this environment and I didn't like his attitude. Mm. Although he was, I have to say, at that time, I mean, he was very, very helpful and positive to me. Actually, one of his former students, Joe Herbert, who was here in Cambridge, and I came up to see Joe, who... Because you're in a difficult position when you've had this kind of relationship with somebody who you felt was no fault of your own, and all you'd done was worked hard and produced well, and suddenly been let down very badly. But there was not much you could do about it. Mm. So I came to see Joe to talk to him about it and see what he... Because he knew, because he'd done his PhD with Richard Knight as well. And he was very sympathetic. You know, I do understand. Why don't you come here to Cambridge? Because he started in Cambridge. And I said, well, that would be very nice. And so I brought my money with me to Cambridge for a year. And then I got a fellowship, not a college fellowship, I got a Foundation's Fund for Research in Psychiatry fellowship. And then I got a lectureship within, 2 years or three, two or 3 years, I can't remember exactly. Relatively short period of time.
In the department?
In the department.
Of zoology? Or?
No, this was anatomy.
Anatomy. Mm. Oh,
right. So I then had to learn anatomy. I had to learn how to dissect the whole body and instruct. And I must say, I learned a lot about the brain. A huge amount. Because teaching medics in those days, they had a full year on the brain. Mm. And, you know, I know the brain inside out and backwards and upside down. And, you know, if you get a bullet hole here, I can tell you exactly the structures it's gone through, what the problems will be. It was a complete new discipline. But I don't mind. I love being on a learning curve. I spend my whole life. I'm still on a learning curve. Learning. I mean, I just love learning new things. So I had no problems with doing DR work and teaching and supervising. And I didn't actually supervise the upper limb and the lower limb, because I find them so pretty dull to supervise. There's nothing intellectually challenging about them. But the brain is challenging. Knowing and understanding the brain is very challenging. And I also think that you can't look at the brain in isolation. You need to know how the brain fits in with the body, as it were, and how it responds to the bodily needs as well as tells the body what to do. So I enjoy learning my anatomy and getting
Did no one think it rather odd that someone who knew no anatomy was now a lecturer in anatomy?
I got in my lectureship purely on the basis of my publications and, you know, the how good I was, I guess, how good I looked on paper at any rate. But you're right, except the professor of anatomy was Richard Harris. Richard Harrison, who was really a zoologist. Well, he was a medic, but he was really a zoologist, and he was interested in cetacea. He was interested in dolphins, and he said, "Oh, anybody can learn that," was his attitude, and so I did, and I taught. I mean, I actually gave lectures. I gave lectures on the sympathetic nervous system. I gave lectures on the breast. I gave quite a lot of lectures on the brain. But I also gave lectures on topographical anatomy, for my sins.
When did you come to Cambridge? What year was this about?
I think it was 72. And also, Richard Harrison was very kind of benign. But the second in command was Max Bull, who was an absolutely dyed-in-the-wool anatomist.
Max Bull.
And he was at Queen's College, and he was a tough. And he said, if you're going to teach anatomy, you're going to have to get some teaching experience. And I've got an ideal set up for you to do that with my physiotherapist. He taught the physiotherapist from Bedford, who used to come over once. I think it was once a week or twice a week, I don't remember, and they were taught their anatomy. So I kind of earned my apprenticeship teaching physiotherapists anatomy before I could progress up to teaching the medical students their anatomy. I say progress, but I'm, you know, it's once you know it, you know it. There's nothing intellectually challenging about it at all.
You obviously enjoy teaching. Yeah, or you did enjoy teaching.
Oh, I do. I still do enjoy teaching.
Which kind, particularly? Teaching. I mean, lecturing, supervising, the
students? Both. I supervised right up. I mean, I long after I've been a professor, I supervised for the whole of the second year medics as well as NST students here. But then the college appointed a medic to a fellowship. And he was a medic, and he, part of the fellowship meant that he had to teach, and he was a neurologist, and so he taught the brain, which is what I teach. I was perfectly happy for him to do that. I'm trying to remember the name of the fellowship. It was one that was endowed, but it begins with M. The mathematicians had it first. Anyway, I can't remember. But he took over.
You enjoy lecturing?
Yeah, I do enjoy lecturing.
And you must do quite a lot of PhD supervising, or?
Not now, because I have done PhD supervising. I never had more than two students on the go at one time, so they're overlapping.
Is that intentional,
yeah,
or?
Yeah, it was intentional. Yeah. I didn't want a great crowd of students, and I figured that I could give them. Bearing in mind what I'd been through, I wanted to have a continuously open door and give them undivided attention. But this, of course, when you're due to retire, you can't take on students anymore. So I haven't taken any on, because this is officially my retirement. I haven't taken any on for the last 3 years. Although I'm still carrying on with my research, I've still got grants, and we'll be continuing till the end of next year, possibly longer, I don't know, because I'm a joint holder of the Lever Union with Rob, Pat Nye on one side, and Rob and Mart on the other side, so I'm still engaged and involved with that to some extent. Again, which is very much a part of brain evolution.
Let's go back. I mean, you became a fellow of, was King's College that you became a fellow of?
No, I didn't get a, because I'd not done my undergraduate degree. I didn't get a fellowship, but I did teach. I taught for Kings, actually, in 73, 74, 75. But then Charlie was, I think, very much in favour.
Charlie Loke.
Yeah, of having someone who had a medical qualification. Mm. And the college appointed a pharmacologist called, I can't remember his name, but he went up to a chair up in Edinburgh.
Mm.
You may remember him. He had a limp. I can't remember his name. I'm getting terrible. Mm. But so I didn't get a fellowship here.
Mm. But you must have in the end. I mean, at what point?
Yeah, I then went. I became what was called subdirector of studies for medical sciences at City Sussex, and I taught Newman.
Mm.
I didn't teach topographical upper limb, lower limb, that kind of topographical, but I did teach head and neck, endocrinology, and brain, and both brain and neuroscience, both the anatomy and the physiology, as it was then called.
Mm.
And then, after the pharmacologist, they appointed what was his name from anatomy here, who also went to Edinburgh, Matt Kaufman.
Mm.
Do you remember Matt? He was appointed here as a college lecturer in anatomy.
Mm.
But Matt didn't stay very long. I think he was only here for 3 years, and he moved off to a chair of anatomy in Edinburgh. And then I think by this stage Charlie was a bit disenchanted with people who were not staying around very long, and he asked me if I was still interested. So I said yes, I was, and then I got appointed. So I think it was 1985 before I was appointed a fellow here.
Mm.
In
the university job, were there any people who you particularly worked with or were influenced by? I mean, there are a lot of famous people on the edges of your field in Cambridge.
Oh, there are.
Like,
I mean, Joe was an absolute... Joe Herbert, who I moved to, was the antithesis of Richard Michael.
Mm.
He was completely informal. He was totally disorganized.
Mm.
But brilliant mind. And what Joe taught me to do was really to think about things and think about them hard. He used to use the expression, you have to think about it until it really hurts, and then you've got to think some more. he was good because he always acted as devil's advocate.
Mm.
So when we had all our lab meetings, and you had to be ready because you knew you were going to get it.
Mm.
And Joe didn't hold his punches at all. I mean, this was gloves off intellectually, but at a personal level, he was the warmest, kindest person you can imagine. But he was very rigorous, intellectually rigorous, still is.
Mm.
So I learned a lot from him. And I have also learned a huge amount from Gabriel, as a matter of fact.
Mm.
Not that Gabriel is exactly my subject area, but Gabriel... Is
Gabriel
Horn, yeah. Gabriel's what I call, he's got real leadership qualities. He's absolutely brilliant at motivating people and encouraging people and being very helpful when it's necessary to be helpful. But he kind of, when I moved to, I was asked to, if I would like to take over from Pat. Actually, Pat was the
Pat Bateson.
Pat Bateson, yeah. Mm. Although I did having said that, going back, I did overlap with Gabriel for a few years in anatomy because he was in anatomy when I was there.
Mm.
And he was very, very affable and friendly and come and talk.
Mm.
He was the only person in the whole department apart from Joe, because all of the medics, and I was the first non-medic ever appointed, myself and Martin Johnson both appointed at the same time, and all of the other medics kind of, well, I wouldn't say they sent us to Coventry, but they were not warm and welcoming, and they do always have this, you know, you're not medically qualified type of attitude at the back of their minds, which, I mean, I'm prepared to say I knew my anatomy better than them, because at the end of it, because it's something you can know and know, once you know it, that's it. But you know, you can then, if you're a thinking person, you can elaborate on things and put things together in a different sort of way. But Gabriel wasn't like that at all. Gabriel was keen on anyone doing research, keen on things happening. And I was the first person to introduce radioactivity into the anatomy department, which caused all sorts of problems. And for doing radio immune assays, and Gabriel came and said, "Hey, how did you do that? What do you know?" And he was really, really interested in what was going on. Probably can't remember that now, but I remember it very well, because he was very positive and very. He made me feel important, you know. And nobody else in the department, apart from Joe, who was lovely, nobody else in the department ever spoke to me. Because Harrison had been very welcoming. Nevertheless, I mean, you know, he was busy doing his own things. He was head of department, and he was also, he was nice whenever you saw him and helpful, but he kind of was a bit detached from the department. He had his own things going at the zoo and things going at the Royal Society and what have you.
Finish off on one or two people. You mentioned Gabriel warmly.
Yeah.
The other people who I've interviewed might be in your sort of on the edges of your field. One was Robert Hind.
Yeah, Robert is a super person. Absolutely.
He's been
very positive and very encouraging and very helpful. Again, my research overlapped a little bit with Robert's, because he was interested in mother-infant relationship and family relationships. And I had been very much interested in mother-infant relationship at a mechanistic level, in terms of how the brain works to regulate that behavior, and the importance of hormones, again, in maternalism and maternal behavior. And now I'm talking about animals here, because what is interesting about all mammals is that you actually have two generations developing in one individual. You have the infant and the placenta, which is also fetal, that actually communicates with mother to extract resources, but also to tell the mother's brain what to do. So the fetal placenta, this is fetal genome tells the maternal genome that it's important that she takes on more food, even though she's not at that moment in those weeks in time in need of it. She doesn't need the calories because the fetus is too small, but she will need it for the last trimester of pregnancy when she can't eat enough to feed the fetus, and also for postpartum sucking. And it also talks to the brain, the placenta, to inform or prime the brain ready for maternal care, and prime the mammary gland ready for more flat time. So there's this interaction going on in utero, which ensures that good mothering follows. Now, what is interesting about human behavior is that humans don't have to go, women don't have to go through pregnancy and parturition to be perfectly good mothers. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't have it doesn't help it in ways. I'm not saying it has no impact, but it's not necessary. Whereas in all other mammals, it's deterministic. All other mammals, except for large brain mammals like primates, for example, where mothering is very much a learnt occupation. You see that mothers will allow their older daughters and their sisters to handle their offspring. And particularly their daughters, and if the daughters get it wrong, she'll go and cuff them around the ear and take the baby back. So there's a learning process going on. And I think that learning process is crucially important in terms of maternal care, and perhaps the most important component of maternal care in large brain mammals. And one thing about the human brain in particular is that it continues to develop postnatally for 17 years, up until late puberty. It's between 17 and 21 are the final years of maturation. There's no more growth, but there's a complete pruning and remodeling of the brain, particularly those areas of the brain that are concerned with forward planning and with controlling emotional behaviour. So really, this care goes on, not just in utero, as it were, but for many, many years afterwards. Most of the brain development occurs postnatally, and when you've got a large brain, then you need to be giving the kind of care that is important for that brain to develop, in other words, in the most appropriate social environment. And the other thing that interested me about maternal care is the mechanisms, the neural and the endocrine mechanism, in particular, the way the hormones act on the brain to prime neuropeptides, in particular oxytocin, for maternal care. And what is interesting about what is mechanistically acting within relatively small brain mammals in a deterministic way for maternal care is also the same mechanism that is acting in humans and monkeys in terms of their social interactions. So that was the next thing I got on to working. First of all, working on maternal mother-infant interactions in a relatively small brain mammal like the sheep, for example, where you get the mother bonding with her lamb. And there's that important bonding going on and the mechanism of that. And then secondly, how living socially and having a large brain, and most of it developing postnatally, what changes have had to occur in brain evolution in order to encompass that? What were the changes that allowed that to happen? And so I spent quite a lot of time doing that, and it's interesting that the basic mechanism, so if you look in sheep, for example, the mechanisms are very much, and in all small brain mammals, very much driven by olfaction again. Olfactory cues are the most important recognition cues between mother and infant. But when you get to the high primates and indeed humans, olfaction plays very much less of a role. But what is important is the what I call the brain's reward mechanism, how the brain's reward mechanism fits in. It's the same in both. It's the same basic structure in terms of the hypothalamic mechanisms and the oxytocins and the receptors and the brain's reward mechanism. But what's happened as the brain's got bigger is that reward system now responds to a lot of input from other parts of the brain. It's not just regulated by these neuroendocrine mechanisms. It's the brain has got larger to such an extent that it's becoming self-regulatory, and it regulates itself. Although in regulating itself, it has to go through a very, very, very long learning process, social learning process, to be adequate, to be able to do behaviors. I mean, we kind of think about everything we do is being straightforward and natural, but unless you've watched a mother interacting with a young child, I mean, I didn't see it so much with my own kids, but with my grandchildren, I see how much effort mothers put into their babies to get them to stand up, to get them to feed themselves, to get them to walk. The amount of positive reinforcement and encouragement, I mean, it's just obsessional. But it works. And you find that kids that have been brought up in away from home, where these children have been neglected and they're brought up in a sort of nursery, they don't learn to walk. They don't learn to talk. They just, you know, it's unbelievable. You never think of we've actually learned to. You don't think of it as being a learning process. You think it's natural, but it isn't. You have to, everything that the human brain does pretty well is it depends upon learning.
You mentioned 17 to 21 as the sort of age at which the brain reaches its sort of maximum.
Right.
Is that also the time by which this socialization of learning process has reached its...
reached the age of reason, I think. I think post-puberty is the age of reason, where you, you're less driven by your emotions, or the emotions are there, but now, instead of the emotions controlling you, your brain has that possibility to regulate the emotions.
And this is achieved, hopefully, by 17, 18, that sort of...
It starts around about 17, right? It's the prefrontal cortex which is maturing, which, of course, is a bit of a worry in modern-day kids who are now coming into puberty at junior school. So they're coming into reproductive maturity long before they're coming into emotional and rational maturity.
Because emotional and rational maturity still is at, what, 17, 18?
Well, the brain, yeah. That's exactly... I mean, now they've got much more insights into that with the MRI scans, and they can see what is happening. And essentially, what it is a pruning and rewiring. It's not growth in the sense of new neurons forming. It's growth, the fact that neurons are dying, and the biggest increase is in the white matter, which is innervating those neurons. But what I think what interests me is that biology is very conservative in that it's taken this mother-infant interaction, in it, which is deterministic, but that and mother-infant bonding, but that is the same mechanism which is expanded into social bonding. It's the same neural mechanisms that are being called into play in terms of social bonding and social cohesion. And it's also the same mechanism, incidentally, which is usurped by addiction. So any kind of addiction, be it alcohol, be it smoking, be it drugs of abuse, cocaine, heroin. And what is really sad about those drugs is they also destroy the maternalism. So heroin addicted mothers, usually within, within a year of birth, something like half of them are taken into care, and by the time they reach school age, it's 90%. When I say taken into care, it's not always into state care, but by a relative, by a grandmother or mother. So the next thing that I became interested in research-wise was trying to figure out how things are put together at a molecular genetic level. And of course that is an enormous task, because there are so many genes that you could pick on. How do you pick on them? How do you know which ones to go for? What is the important thing? Well, I was lucky in a way, because I knew Azim Sarani, and he had just discovered genomic imprinting. Well, he discovered it, but nobody believed him. And he discovered it in the context of the placenta. And I was interested in it so far as the brain was concerned, although there were no imprinted genes at that stage. So what we did is we got the whole of the genome imprinted. Imprinted genes are normal autosomal genes which are expressed according to parent of origin. So there are some of your genes which you've inherited from mum and dad, but only your fathers are expressed. And there are other genes which only your mothers are expressed. So some are maternally imprinted and silent, some are paternally imprinted and silent. So they're monoallelic rather than biallelic. And you can try and figure out what the whole of the imprinted genome is doing by making parthenogenetic or androgenetic animals, which you can do by, you know, putting the nucleus from an egg into an egg, and you get a haploid organism. All of the genes have come from mum. You can do the same by taking out the female nucleus and putting two male nuclei in. But then it's lethal very, very early in development because of the placenta primarily. But what you can do is you can make chimeras. That is to say, you can take cells and make them parthenogenetic or androgenetic. And providing they don't exceed 40% of the total, they will survive. And that is a very big impact on both brain growth, brain size at birth, and on whereabouts they're going to in the brain. And since then I've been following through imprinted genes, and to cut a long story short, I'm still interested in them, I'm still interested in brain evolution, but I'm going back to that maternalism and mother-infant, and how important the matriline has been in this context. And I'm particularly interested now in how the brain and placenta have co-adaptively evolved. And that's the things that I'm currently working on. I'm also working still on olfaction, because I'm interested in small brain mammals. Olfaction is the most important sensory system they have, and how adaptive that might be. How adaptive it might be according to the environment they're in, because you may not know this, but your olfactory and your pheromone, well, we don't have the pheromone receptors, but animals' olfactory and the vomeronasal pheromone receptors are continually turning over, the receptor neurons. These are the only neurons, or were thought to be the only neurons in the brain which regenerate. We now know there are some that go to the hippocampus as well. But anyway, the question is, if they're continually turning over, are they coming up with the same repertoire? Or is their turnover being selected in such a way that they're better able to respond to the environment in which they find themselves? And that's what I'm interested in now. So both of these things are interesting not so much from a genetic point of view, but from an epigenetic point of view. In other words, genes which are regulated and expressed as a result of environmental influences and are environmentally modifiable. And it's that epigenetic process that makes them environment. So evolution, as it were, is in part dependent on environmental selective things, but it may not be just a passive selection, it may be much more active than we previously thought.
Fascinating. So many things that arise out of that. I mean, just on the, a lot of your description at the end reminded me of your early interest in chess. I mean, the complexity of solving these problems is like playing multi-dimensional chess against a very good opponent.
Well, the difference with science is the only opponent is yourself, because it's an intellectual challenge, and you're challenging yourself to try and get an answer, and you don't always come up with the right answer. I think that's, to be perfectly honest, but you are continuously challenging yourself, and so if you try and think about genes and behavior. Well, first of all, genes don't code for behavior. Genes control, code for the coding of the brain. How do you know what time, what part of that brain development is crucially important? How do you know which of the genes are the ones to try and get a handle on this very, very, very big program that's going on? And so there have been really the challenging questions. How to, as it were, be able to narrow things down without losing track of the big picture. And I think that's what's really interesting me, and what got me interested in this special aspect of mammalian gene regulation called genomic imprinting. It's a relatively few imprinted genes.
Have you, in trying to solve these problems, have you found any techniques which encourage you to, or help you to find answers? I mean, I'm thinking of very crude things, but some of the people I've talked to have, like Pat and Gabriel and so on, have said that walking together, conversations with their colleagues, or particular stimulants to making larger leaps or paradigm shifts.
I think certainly discussing things with colleagues. So if I go back to the early work, discussing things with Joe in particular, if I go to the more recent work, discussing things with Azim, and with my interest in the placenta, discussing things with Charlie. These, because Charlie is not interested and doesn't know about the brain, Azim doesn't know about the brain, but, they have in-depth knowledge which I have had to generate in myself, and the easiest way to generate knowledge about a completely new area is to talk to somebody who's interested in it. Because then you get, especially if it's a fellow scientist, because then you get the social enthusiasm, you know, the contact, the enthusiasm, and the sowing of seeds that make you want to know more about this. It's not quite so, oh, this is intellectually important, I'll go and read about it. Because you do go and read about it, but you need some primers, you need some direction, as it were, and some discussion on which to go about it. I mean, Azim is the most modest person you could ever imagine. He would never forgive me for saying that he's been extremely stimulating.
I'm hoping to interview him shortly, so.
Are you?
I've asked him, yes.
Oh, yeah, he's lovely.
It's notable, well, perhaps it's just a coincidence, but the two people you mentioned there, Charlie Loke and Azim Surai, are both fellows of King's. I mean, some people, Pat and Gabriel, for example, and others have mentioned that a collegiate structure, as I've found, helps long-term conversations with people, because you don't need to force it, but you meet them.
That's right.
Socially and continue a conversation.
No, that's absolutely true, and I would agree with that. I would also say that supervising is a wonderful stimulus as well, believe it or not, because it forces you to keep broad. So it's no good my saying, I work on the hypothalamus in the brain and I know about that. You know, you don't. You have to put that into the context of everything else. And every year I used to find students would ask me questions in a way that I hadn't really put it together that way before. You know, it's not that I didn't know all of the answers and all of the bits, but I hadn't put them in quite that format before. And they'd asked a question and I thought, yeah, that's interesting. That's an interesting way of looking at it. So, and there was never a year went by when I didn't at some point get some kind of stimulus. I mean, it's always rewarding to teach young minds, but it's rewarding as well in terms of stimulating yourself and keeping yourself aware of things.
And coming back again to the college, are there any other people in the college who, I mean, Sydney Brenner, Pat Bates? And
Sydney is somebody I have an enormous admiration for. I mean, I love to listen to Sydney and I love to talk to Sydney. He can be extremely rude and he can be extremely put down, you know, put you down just like that, but I'm prepared to put up with it. Because, in fact, when I was admitted for my fellowship, I sat next to Sydney. And I came away feeling about this big, you know. I'm like, what am I doing going to King's with people like this there? But on other occasions, you know, I've spoken to him. And I know him well enough now to realise that Sydney's not a very good listener. But a few prime words and you can get absolutely monumental amount of knowledge and information and ideas that come out. I'm not saying they're all right, but you know, Sydney is just pure crystallized intellect genius, I think. Now I have a lot of time for him.
Several of the people I've interviewed said he's the cleverest man in Cambridge.
Absolutely. Without any, in my view, cleverest man I know, without any question of doubt. And I'm proud to have been at the same college with Sydney. There are times when I could strangle him, but especially if. But you learn. If you come with a guest, one thing you don't do is you don't introduce him to Sydney. you let Sydney want to come over and talk. And then it's fine. But,
What about Pat Bateson? Did you come across him? Because he was the predecessor.
I took over from Pat. But of course then Pat came here to become Provost of King's. And I kind of went into Madingley to take Madingley in a slightly different direction to what Pat had done. But so there was a time when he was here. And so we were not really interacting very much. But since he stopped being prophet, and came to Medding, he's been involved much more with myself and postdoc and graduate student, and we have been doing things together. Mm. And Pat is now very interested in epigenetics because he likes that way of being able to engage the environment in terms of gene environment interactions in terms of developing the brain and developing behaviour. Mm. So I think he's enthusiastic about that. Mm. And he's enthusiastic about the work that I do.
Two final questions. One was not sure whether you fully finished off the earlier story you were telling about the similarities and the differences between human brains and other higher mammals.
Yeah.
You said they were very similar, but there was something special about the human brain, and you even linked it to perhaps to imagination or to religion or something like that.
What I would link it to is the long developmental process that it undergoes postnatally. Mm. So the brain that is forming continuously in a social environment, and that is what shapes the brain, what makes the connections and what makes different connections in different individuals. So that, I think, is very important. Now, in terms of religion, if you like, or in terms of belief systems, we all of us need belief systems in the sense that we all of us understand what we mean by guilt and what we mean by shame and what we mean by blame. And if we didn't ever feel guilty or shameful, then, you need an internal representation of self to be able to feel guilty. You need to know what you should be and what you're not being, and you're not matching up to the standards that you set for your internal representation of self. Now, some people, that internal representation of self, they put God in that place, or they put some religious being in that place to set that standard. I don't feel you need any external reference point. I think it's an internal reference point, but you definitely need that internal reference point. You can't. And that's what comes to you when you reach maturity, being able to value your relationships and value your what you put into them and value all of the things you do, really, in terms of what you expect of yourself. Mm. It's so all of the things that I've achieved, as it were, I feel that I've had a lot of influence from other people, but I don't thank God for it, if you know what I mean. I think that it's come about partly through my own direction, but partly through, especially through, in fact, being in an environment like Cambridge. Mm. Cambridge is just such a wonderful place for anyone who wants to learn and be curious. I mean, it's just full of it. You could live 1,000 years and or compress your lifetime into and expand it to 1,000 years and go off in all different disciplines and learn something. You never come to an end of it. It's absolutely wonderful. Mm. I think what you've got to be careful about is losing focus. So it's very easy to lose focus because there's so many things which are intellectually stimulating. Mm-hmm.
We covered a great deal, but sometimes one misses some important point. I don't know whether, for instance, you're married or have a family. Or
I am married. My wife is Spanish, and I just thought we were here to talk about academic things. But no, the crucially important part of my life. I have three children who are now grown up, and the two daughters have children, so I have grandchildren. And that has been my, as it were, secure base from which I've operated. That has always been there. It has always been welcoming. It has always understood me. It has always allowed me to do the things that might not necessarily generate a lot of income and what have you. But it has been, well, I don't think I could have done anything without it. We all need a secure base from which to operate, and my home is my security. And I don't force my family to engage with what I do academically. Mm. I mean, if they're interested, then great. But I don't. It's not that I keep it separate, but it's just that it's a different story.
Mm.
It's a different part of my life, but an equally important part.
Mm. And presumably, watching the interaction, mother, as you said, with grandchildren particularly.
I didn't notice it with my own children so much, I have to say, and yet I'm I watch behaviour. But you're too involved, you're too emotional, you're too close. You can't stand back and look at it and see it in the same way that you do with your grandchildren.
Mm.
Then it becomes very clear and very obvious that gosh, all that time and effort and praise and cuddling and warmth, you know, just to get them to stand up. It's amazing.
Mm.
And then, you know, when Dad comes home, look, watch this. And it goes over again, and kisses and huddles and warmth. And the child thinks, what have I done? You know, big smiles all around.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think Abby, that's great.
Is there anything else that you would like to have me to ask you or talk about?
I don't think so. Do you talk about honours and awards and things like that? I was made a fellow of the Royal Society in
97.
I'm a fellow, an honorary foreign fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in, I think it was 2 years after. A fellow of the Academy of Medical Sciences. Is it the Academy of Medical Sciences or Academy of Medical Sciences? The British, I can never remember the names of these things. I was awarded the Viersmith Professorship at Caltech University. And
Calcut.
Caltech.
Caltech.
California.
California, yeah.
I can't think of the others. There are a number of awards and honorary lectures and goodness knows what else, but they'll be
on your website.
But they're standard. They're all, yeah, well, everything's on my CV.
Mm.
They're standard for Cambridge, anyway.
Mm. Yep, it's that high standard around here.
I mean, you know, it's when you're talking about Nobel Prizes that you think
about. I'm two, if possible. Anyway, thank you very much indeed, Barry. I think that's covered everything. Okay?
My pleasure. Thank you.